Live from the heart of the universe, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright.
We have tonight's guest, distinguished fellow, adjunct professor, and co-founder of Prison of Peace, Doug Knoll. And performance guest, Freddie Revell. I am Mark Leger, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
Boy, if we've ever had a doubleheader of an episode, this would be it. With our two guests, our performance guests and our interview guests, we're in for a really great, great time and a lot of learning for those of us who are into that. And it's really interesting that without knowing that this is where we were going to go with this, both our guest and our performance guest in the course of conversations brought up the word empathy. Interestingly enough, empathy, it's so powerful, it can drive winning results. That was inspired by our guest. That is episode 884 of the Life Changes Show. And for some reason, because of that word, maybe that title, I thought of something that happened many years ago before I had certain tools, or even you'll hear what my own criticism of myself, tools or no tools. Many years ago, I had a neighbor who was pleasant, and I was pleasant to her, and we got along pleasantly, as we all did in the neighborhood. And then there was what seemed hopefully to be an isolated incident that was a little bit disruptive to the neighborhood. And I just assumed it would be an isolated incident. And so I didn't say anything about it. And I was hoping nobody else would say anything about it because, you know, things happen. Instead, it wasn't an isolated incident. And it was something that happened over and over and over and didn't get changed and didn't get fixed. And I thought, well, she's probably on her way to fixing it, or somebody else will probably mention it and we'll just leave it at that. But weeks passed and I happened to run into her. And at this point, I thought I should bring this up. And so I brought it up thinking, I'm sure you're going to fix this situation. And she started to talk about something seemingly unrelated. And so I brought the conversation eventually back and I said, well, this specifically in this situation, and it's disruptive. And she seemed to talk about, again, something entirely different. Like, she didn't say, like, my husband just died or something like that. So, but it was like not related, in my opinion. However, if I had read our guest's book, maybe I would have thought differently. The book being Deescalate: How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. Now, I was the one that actually was getting angry, but I might have had an opportunity for empathy. The ability to identify with or understand another's situations or feelings. So had I maybe identified, I might have felt a little differently or acted a little differently or reacted a little differently. So all this to say, I was frustrated to begin with and then started getting a little bit angry and I got a little louder and she continued and then I got loud enough and something happened, or not loud enough, I got louder and something happened. It was almost as if something triggered in her in a good way. She stopped, she looked at me, and she said, I could see you're angry. And it was the first time I thought she actually heard me. And I said, yes, well, yes, I'm frustrated because, and then we went from there. Interestingly enough, she said she would take care of the situation, which she did within a short period of time. And I had so much respect for her. And I thought, where did she get that? Like, how did she know that? And what took her so long to pull that out? And then I thought, well, wait a minute. I have tools too. Why didn't I pull out any of my tools before even getting to the point where she had to eventually pull that one out? And so it led me to an interesting thought process that, A, there are tools, some tools I didn't know back then, some tools I still don't know, but there are tools. And B, it's good to know the tools. C, it's good to actually put those tools to use. So tonight we're going to learn some tools, and I trust that we'll incorporate them and put them to use.
I felt like I was going to have to de-escalate for a moment there during the monologue.
This was a long time ago, but things happen all the time.
And tools evolve. And
yeah,
I'm truly excited. I think what you said tonight about the double power, the back-to-back that we have, two just fantastic guests. I'm so excited also for Freddie. He's got such a presence when you get the opportunity to see him live, and I'm just so excited he's with us tonight.
Yeah, actually, speaking of Freddie, he is the keynote maestro. He's the founder of Life in Tune, and he's a number one charting pianist. He's a producer of Grammy-winning projects, a world-class musician with powerful leadership insights. So it really ties in beautifully.
More tools.
More tools.
He's got a lot of tools.
And interesting, would you say that? Because tools, you said something up, tools evolve. Well, he's evolved tools, and we're going to learn from our guest that there are some tools that we were taught years ago that maybe we weren't taught the right way, or we know better now, or he knows better.
Well, some of those tools long time ago would actually escalate things.
Yes, and maybe that was the purpose, who knows? Well, empathy, it's so powerful, it can drive winning results. Episode 884 of the Life Changes Show features our interview guest, who's a distinguished fellow of the International Academy of Mediators. He's co-founder of Prison of Peace. He's adjunct professor at Pepperdine University's Strauss Institute for Dispute Resolution. He's ranked it's ranked number one in the nation. He's a speaker and an author of the book I just mentioned and a couple others that we'll talk about. He is Doug Knoll. Welcome, Doug, to the Life Changes Show.
Hey, Filippo, great to be here.
I
love your story. There's so many cool things we could talk about in that story.
I don't want to stop you. Go ahead. I mean, tell me everything I did wrong.
Oh no! First of all, the lady you were talking to got it. With I would do one small change, but by naming your emotion, she, in effect, labeled you, and that has the effect in the brain of quieting the centers of the brain that are associated with negative emotion and activating a part of the brain called the right ventral lateral prefrontal cortex, the thinking part of the brain. And it all happens automatically, and every human brain is hardwired for this. So just by saying, you're angry, she said, I think you're angry. I don't teach the use of I statements, but it's really simple. You feel X. And that has an immediate calming effect. So that was really cool. And then the other thing you said that is so classic, I got louder and I got louder. And I got louder. And this happens in every single argument. Why do we get louder? Because we're not being heard.
Oh.
So I'm getting excited. I get too close to the mic. we're not feeling heard. And the paradox of argument is we want to be heard. The other side wants to be heard. So we both start shouting each other to be heard, and all we have to do is stop shouting and start listening. And the argument goes away, just like that.
Brilliant. So she had since we're using this as a use case, she had that tool, but for whatever reason, she hadn't. It hadn't escalated to the point of, oh, this is a real thing. We're not just having a conversation on this. I'm assuming. And I was thinking, had she pulled that out sooner? Well, I wasn't angry sooner. Well, interesting. I'm trying to analyze something that I don't really quite have the grasp of. And therein lies the problem, is that we're not taught this.
That's right. We're not taught any of these skills. You started off being frustrated, and then when you weren't being listened to, you weren't being heard, that frustration led to disrespect, which led to a feeling of being unheard and invisible, again, disrespect, which then morphed into anger. And she was finally saw the anger and reflected that you were angry, and that's when you calmed down. We can stop it a lot earlier by simply saying, you're feeling really disrespected right now. Mm. Lippo, you don't feel like you're being heard. You feel invisible. You don't feel appreciated. And you don't feel like you're being listened to. And that's really disrespecting to you. And it kind of pisses you off.
Now, talk about tools from the past. I remember specifically being taught, and we used to talk about it in this way, that we say, when you do that, I feel, or it makes me feel. Talk to us about that.
That's the old Thomas Gordon methodology, which was kind of stolen by Carl Rosenberg in Nonviolent Communication and rebranded it as NVC. There is nothing wrong with that formulation for asserting your own feelings, but it absolutely does not work when you are trying to name somebody else's feelings. So if I listen to the difference between this, Filippo, it seems to me that you're really angry and upset versus Filippo, you're really pissed off, angry and upset. Which one lands quicker?
Okay. The second one lands quicker, actually.
Absolutely.
But the first one lands better.
the problem with the I statement is that when somebody's really upset, their cognitive processing has been completely shut down because their threat status is so high that the body is mobilizing for flight or fight. Mm. And so the prefrontal cortex literally shuts down and you can't think. When you use an I statement, that requires too much cognitive processing and people just can't process it. So they get really frustrated with that. And the easier way to do it is to simply say you, much less cognitive processing, and causes people to calm down in 90 to 120 seconds. It's amazing to watch. And it happens every single time because every single human brain is hardwired to react this way. It's crazy.
Now, that statement really struck me. Every single human brain is hardwired. I actually read it in the book, I think, somewhere, and I wrote it down to talk to you about that. So mm-hmm. We are hardwired for something that we are not taught that we are even hardwired. I mean, I don't know if we're hardwired for a lot of things, but if we're hardwired for that, this sounds important.
It is. This is pretty new knowledge because the seminal study was published in 2007, so it hasn't even been 20 years that this knowledge became available to us through brain scanning studies. And the other thing is it flies in the face of everything we think we know about emotions. Emotions are really complex, fascinating things. And of course, the reason that I get interested in it is I'm paid to walk into high-conflict situations every day. Mm. Where there's a lot of money at stake, or there are a lot of relationships at stake, and people are really angry at each other. And in the prisons, there was incipient violence when I was working in prisons, teaching people how to do this. So we're working with high-stakes situations and high emotions. The first thing we have to do is get people to calm down. And the fastest, most effective way to do that is simply to name their emotions with a you statement. You feel. That's all you got to do.
You call it affect labeling.
That's the term that neuroscientists use. So that is the technical term of what it means to name somebody else's emotions from their frame of reference. That's why we use the you statement. The moment that I use an I statement, I'm now speaking from my frame of reference. But I want to speak from your frame of reference. So Filippo, you're angry, you're frustrated, you don't feel heard, you feel invisible, you're anxious and concerned and worried.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's that process that is so powerful that allows you to calm anybody down. If you're a parent, you can stop a two-year-old's tantrum in literally a minute doing this, because the child's brain is hardwired for it.
Why would we be hardwired for empathy?
Oh, how much time do we have? Let me give you the really short version. Most people don't think about when we as Homo sapiens developed the ability to have language. But it turns out that language has only been around for less than 50,000 years. And we've been on the planet in one form or another with our predecessors for over 2.5 million years. How did we communicate without language? Through emotion. And as you said before, I came on, you said empathy is the ability to read and understand somebody else's emotions. I think it's a little, I'm going to put a more precise spin on it here in the 21st century. But this idea of being able to read somebody else's emotions was hardwired into us millions of years ago, because that's the only way we could communicate, was through emotional expression, because we didn't have words. We didn't have vocabulary. We didn't have language. None of that existed until about 50,000 years ago. So we are finally attuned to read each other's emotions. And I think I don't know this for a fact, so this is more supposition than anything else. I think that as a result of that, the ability to read somebody else's emotions and let them know what they're feeling had a calming effect on people. And that has stayed with us for a long, long time. It's still with us today. So I think that's what's going on. The fact of the matter is, you name somebody's emotions, they're going to calm down.
So is that what's happening? Like, for example, people are arguing with each other or hating on each other, and then there's an earthquake or something, or there's a 9/11 attack, and then all of a sudden they're hugging each other and crying. And is that similar?
Well, I don't think so. I think what happens there is that you have an event that transcends the current little conflict or dispute or argument. Something transcends that,
okay,
and causes people to bond together. You know, where they were arguing, all of a sudden their argument pales in comparison to this catastrophe, like, let's say, 9/11. And now they recognize that they've got more in common than they have in difference, and so it brings them together. And we see a lot of that. But for day-to-day kinds of conflicts, and for situations where there isn't some kind of catastrophe that brings people together, having this tool completely changes your life. Completely. Imagine never having a fight or argument spiral out of control again in your life, ever.
Mm. What a world we would have.
Exactly. And imagine being able to walk into any room, no matter how intense the situation, and know exactly what to say, how to say it, and know exactly what's going to happen when you speak those words. Utter confidence with pure compassion. Powerful.
Very. So earlier you said something about calming a two-year-old, and mm-hmm. when you and I were speaking, I asked you, what's the youngest somebody could learn these tools? Said 2 years old.
I know you can start using it on two-year-olds, because I have gotten many, many emails from parents with very young toddlers, children, who've started affect labeling their children and seen remarkable results. I've gotten emails where saying our toddler was going through terrible twos. We started affect labeling. No more tantrums after 4 months.
Wow.
Zero. Gone away. The research supports this. There's all kinds of research that supports that if parents become emotional coaches for their children through labeling and naming emotions, by the time the children are 8 years old, they're 2 or 3 grade levels ahead of their peers, academically, cognitively. as opposed to children who don't get that benefit, who are emotionally invalidated, which is where the way most of us were raised. You know, you go out and you fall down at 3 years old and you skin your knee and you start crying. And what are you told? Stop crying. Man up. Be tough. Big boys don't cry. That's the most insidious and pervasive form of child abuse that exists, mm-hmm. because you're denying the child what he or she is feeling. Instead, validate. Oh, you're scared. You're frightened. You're a little embarrassed. You feel kind of stupid. And it hurts. And all of a sudden goes from cries to giggles. That fast. And you're teaching the child something really important. How to manage his or her own emotions.
So say we're in an argument with somebody and in order to win, quote unquote, the argument, we have been, you like that word? We, you want to stop me there already?
Keep going. Fight to be right, of course.
Uh-huh. Well, and bring the quote unquote opponent down. Like you don't want to name their anger. You want to bring them to shame. You want to say you should be whatever, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you win, no?
Well, that's how you think you win, but that's how you lose. That's how you lose. Because nobody ever really wins an argument. I mean, I was a trial lawyer for 22 years. I tried hundreds of jury trials. You know, we've gotten into this place where we think that arguments are kind of like a courtroom, and they aren't. Mm. And our interactions are not like lawyers arguing or cross-examining people in a courtroom. A courtroom is a very different place. It's a highly structured environment. And there are a lot of rules around how and what you can say in a courtroom. Those rules don't apply when you're in your kitchen. And so, and what do we mean by win anyways? That I'm going to humiliate you and you're going to bend over and bow to my superior wisdom and argumentative skills? Mm. And what does that do to our relationship? Mm. Why do I need to be right? You know, why can't I just acknowledge your feelings? I don't have to agree with you. I can say, Filippo, man, you're really pissed off. You're angry. You're frustrated. You're embarrassed. And you're sad. And you feel alone. Because those are your feelings. I don't have to agree with any of the reasons why you might feel that way. But I can validate how you feel in that moment. And that's the power. That builds relationship. It doesn't tear us down. And once you calm down, then we can talk about what the differences are. How do we solve this problem? How do we make things right? What do we need to do in the future to make sure this doesn't happen again? But you can't get into those discussions until you're calm. So you've got to name the emotions you feel before you do anything else.
Does this work in the courtroom?
No. Because the courtroom is not the kind of place where you do this sort of thing. The
really?
Courtroom, like I said, is a highly structured environment. And you would never, I'd have to really think hard about this. But at least in the kinds of cases I handle, if you had an upset witness, I really didn't ever see too many upset witnesses. But you don't have there's no reason to de-escalate anybody in the courtroom, because typically you don't see strong emotions in a courtroom.
Oh.
Where you actually have the privilege of being able to name them and calm people down. You only have, as a lawyer, you only have a right to speak at certain times, and you can only say certain things.
Wow.
And then only in a certain way. And so de-escalation, you could de-escalate somebody out in the hallway, but probably not in the courtroom while court is in session.
So de-escalate, how to calm an angry person in 90 seconds or less. You actually start the book right off the bat with a particular situation that was real life in a prison.
That's right. That was the first story. So briefly, Laurel Coffer, my co-founder, and I started working in the largest, most violent women's prison in the world, training 15 women, all serving life and long-term sentences, how to become peacemakers and mediators. And the first skill we taught them was how to listen to emotions. And so we were about 5 weeks into the program, and we show up in this dingy conference room where we were teaching these women. Prisons are not pleasant places to teach, by the way. And this woman, Sarah, one of our students, was in the corner sobbing. And we walk up to her, and Laurel says, "What's going on?" And she tells us a story. "I've been in prison for 18 years. I'm serving a 25 to life sentence for a fatal DUI. I killed a family of four as a drunk driver. Mm. When I went to prison, I had to give up my three-year-old boy to my sister to raise. And he's never visited. I've written to him every single week for 18 years. He's never visited me. He's never called me. He's never written me back. Last week, I decided to write a different kind of letter to him. I thought about what it must be like to be the son of an alcoholic killer for a mother. Angry, abandoned, rejected, lonely, upset, ashamed, embarrassed, really angry. And so that's what I wrote to him. And today, for the first time in 18 years, I got a letter back from him. And at the end of the letter, he said, "Mom, I love you. I'm bringing my girlfriend. We're coming to visit you in 3 weeks." And she held up the letter, and you could see the ink had run from her tear stains, and her thumb was over the word love, like she was trying to hold on to it to make sure that it was really real. And that's when it really hit me what we were doing. That was 5 weeks into what is now a project that's been going on for 16 years. I mean, that was an amazing moment.
That story hit me when I read it, and now it hit me again having you share it like that. It's very beautiful, and thank you. And on the one hand, it sounds like it's a bit of psychology. It sounds like it's a bit of communication skills. You're saying that there are studies that back all of this up.
Correct. So if people want to read the seminal study, just go on to Google or go onto your favorite AI platform and put in the words, "Get me the article, putting feelings into words." And it'll give you the published paper by Matthew Lieberman and his colleagues at UCLA, which was the seminal brain scanning study that showed what happens in the brain when you name feelings. There have been about at least 10, maybe probably more studies on affect labeling, direct studies on affect labeling since then. And there are dozens of studies around, for example, affect labeling children, being an emotional coach as a parent, how that affects the developing brain of a small child in a positive way and the effects that it has, you know, even 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years later in life, how it changes how the brain grows. So, yeah, there's just a ton of science out there. And the sad thing is that it's not making it into mainstream media. I'm not sure why that is. This stuff is so powerful. And yet it so I guess it's my mission.
Well, thank you for taking it on.
It's my mission to bring it out here and make everybody aware of this stuff.
So powerful and so important. And, of course, important for all of us listening. However, I had no idea, and I think I asked by accident, quote unquote, a question that I almost thought was unrelated, but your answer tells me this is more important than we can ever imagine, that what happens to children being taught this before they go to school?
Oh, it's huge. What the experience that parents have when they start affect labeling their children, even three-year-olds who are now becoming verbal, and four-year-olds especially, within 2 or 3 or 4 weeks of labeling a child's emotions, they start hearing stuff like, "Mommy, you're really mad. Daddy, you're really upset.
Wow.
Daddy, you're really anxious, you're really worried." I mean, it'll be word appropriate for the age. But the kids start to model the behavior that the parents have been demonstrating in front of the children. And it just becomes this amazingly virtuous cycle in a family.
And then when they go to school?
Now they're emotionally self-regulated because they learn that if they get upset, they can just say, "I'm upset, I'm frustrated, I'm angry." And that calms them down because you can do it to yourself just as well as you can do it to another person. So now they can self-regulate. And they have an advantage that other children don't have, in that because they're self-regulated, they have a lot more bandwidth for cognitive capacity, so they learn faster and they grow faster. And of course, they don't get into fights or arguments at school. They simply tell kids you're angry. And they're calm as cucumbers when they do it. And they can handle bullies. They can handle aggressive kids. They can handle sad kids. It's not a big deal to them. They're used to it. This is what they learn how to do. They become peacemakers. How cool is that? 6 years old in kindergarten.
It's extremely cool if you're actually asking the question. And the fact that they can learn more faster and, in a sense, smarter.
Yeah, think about it. Think about how much capacity it takes to experience an emotion, and how it shuts down our deliberative thinking ability and our reasoning ability. When we're emotional, everything shuts down. We have no capacity to think. So if you're a kid and you have out of control emotions, what's going to be your learning capacity in school? It's going to be low, as opposed to a kid who has emotional self-regulation capacity because of being properly coached by parents. That kid is just going to learn more, and it's going to be easier learning because that child is bringing a higher cognitive capacity, more bandwidth, into the classroom, into the learning environment.
So we have obviously learned something very important here for those of us who didn't know this, and I would imagine there are a lot of us who don't. What else is powerful about what we've learned that potentially we can take to the next level as we're bringing this, this conversation to a close, which, because it feels like we're just getting started.
I know, we can talk, yeah.
but the power of this, the power of self-regulating, self-awareness, the power of this, where can it get us?
So a lot of people talk about emotional intelligence, and I claim that emotional intelligence cannot be learned, because emotional intelligence is a measure of a type of social intelligence. That's the phrase was coined by Solovey and Meyer back in 1990. And there were a couple of psychologists who, now one of them is the president of Yale. They were looking at different kinds of social intelligences, and they coined this term emotional intelligence. And they can measure it. So it's like an IQ test. You can't grow your IQ, right? You can measure it. But the way that you can develop your emotional intelligence is by three things: learning how to recognize your own emotions, that's called emotional self-awareness, learning how to regulate your emotions, and learning empathy, cognitive empathy, through the process of affect labeling. The beauty of this is, when you practice naming other people's emotions with a you statement, like we've been talking about, you automatically develop your own emotional self-awareness, and you automatically learn how to self-regulate yourself. It just happens automatically. You don't have to even train or do anything. All you do, you engage in the practice, and you change who you are as a human being. You become more emotionally intelligent. And I've seen this play out thousands of times in maximum security prisons, where we were taking people who were pretty dark, and they came into our program, and they left pretty light. And just by way of example, here in California, we've had 800 of our students who were serving life sentences have released on parole. Not one of them has reoffended.
Mm. Wow. Thank you.
I mean, powerful. This stuff's amazing.
And we're not talking about, like, quote unquote, holding our tongue or just not saying anything or being the peacemaker without these tools, though.
No, we're not talking about any of that stuff. We're talking about listening another person into existence, making them feel heard at a deep level. And when we do that, we free ourselves, we free them, and we connect all of us.
You have a TED Talk coming up, listening another person into existence.
Yep.
Can you give us a teaser? I think we just got one, but a little more.
You heard the closing line. I'm speaking at TEDx Apex. That's in Apex, North Carolina, Raleigh-Durham, April 18th. And it's my first TEDx. I'm really excited about it. I've got a really powerful talk planned. And, you know, it's an idea worth spreading. And I think the idea worth spreading is learning how to listen somebody into existence.
Please share it with us when you do it so that we could share it as well. It is.
I'll do that.
Very worthwhile. And I want to let everybody know that on the LifeChangesShow.com website, where we have listed our guest, Doug Knoll, N-O-L-L, we also posted a video, how to have a calm conversation
good.
with the politically polarized person. And so as we bring this portion of our show to a close, Doug, why is that important right now?
And I have no clue, Filippo. There's no such thing as political polarization, right?
If there were,
well, you know, you ask four questions and you affect label every answer. The first question is, what are all the life experiences that brought you to the beliefs that you have today? Second question, how do your beliefs and values serve you in your everyday decision-making, your everyday life? Third question, what do you do with people who disagree with you about basic values? And fourth question, how do you think our society should be organized to account for 300, here in the United States, 350 million different beliefs and values? How should we account for that? How should we deal with that? Each time the person answers, you listen to their emotions and name their emotions as they talk. And you will quickly find that you have more things in common with this person than you ever could possibly believe.
They also get into story.
That's right. And they start telling their own story, and they really start thinking about, nobody's ever asked that question before. And two, nobody's ever really listened to me before. And there you go. You're listening them into existence, validating their feelings, and learning it from them about what really is important to them. And most of the time, I have found over and over and over again that people that I thought I had radically different beliefs from, we share the same values. It's incredible.
And from there, another world can be born.
That's exactly right. I got a website. I put up a webpage today on my website for everybody who's listening. If you want to learn more about this and get a bunch of freebies like ebooks and papers to explain all this, go to dougknoll.co/life-changes, lowercase. dougknoll.co/life-changes. And I got a beautiful picture of you, Filippo.
You do? Where did you find a beautiful picture of me?
Well, where else? LinkedIn.
I'm actually curious enough to go, and let me see. It's not active yet, so it might take a moment.
It should be.
Might take
Maybe
a moment.
Maybe I screwed up.
Knowing that it's there. So Life Changes, correct?
Yeah, it should be dougknoll.co / life changes.
Oh, .co. I did
.com is my website. .co is my bit.ly short link.
Ah, okay. Well, and of course, Doug Knoll, NOLL.com is your website where the other information is available and lots of wonderful opportunities to learn. Now, there is the new book coming out, which is Empathy Leadership, right?
Right. Coming out in September. That has a whole story to itself. But briefly, I want as many people in the world as possible to learn these skills. I can't reach 350 million people. So who are the people that are going to be the most influential out there? Leaders. So if I teach them how to use these skills and show them how using these skills leads to profit, bottom line profit, and more engaged, productive teams, every time a leader learns how to listen to and name somebody into existence and models that behavior, 10, 15, 20 people are going to learn how to do it. And then they're going to start modeling. And pretty soon we've got a waterfall. And then from the waterfall, we have a tsunami.
In a good way.
And soon enough, this is mainstream and everybody's doing it. What a different world it would be.
So it is. Well, you here you are. And you're so, right. And thank you. So the book we've been talking about, De-escalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. That's, I have it as Douglas E. Noll, N-O-L-L, right?
Correct.
So either way, people can find it where books are sold. Thank you so much for starting this conversation and being brave to share it as you have.
Well, thank you, Filippo, and thanks for having me on. It's been a great conversation.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much. Oh, my goodness. Mark, you know, he talked about productivity. I just mentioned it as part of the next book, Empathy Leadership, and I was thinking how much more productive we can be when we're not thinking, oh, this person, I think they're angry, and all this stuff that goes in our head when in that moment, when that actually happened, we could say, it seems like you're angry, or it feels to me like you're angry, or no. Did I do it right?
You could de-escalate, yes.
I think I put an I in there. Oh, I don't know. I'll have to go back and listen and read the book.
When you were talking about the kids, it got me thinking because oftentimes they come into their situations coming from a norm of being accelerated. So they're so amplified, so amped up, so stressed around things that they don't know why they're stressed at, and then operating from that place. So what valuable knowledge to impart.
And everything that escalates, like the TV and their phones and maybe kids at school that are bullies and sugar and who knows what else.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. But I'm saying before they even get to school, the parents' stress, the world that we're in, the home life, you don't even know what's going on. And that's their baseline. And then they enter into the rest of that noise. So again, I think being able to impart these tools at such a young age would be so, so very helpful. But the bigger thing that came out of the conversation for me is we've had so many wonderful guests on over the years, but not always is the information immediately usable. Like it's it's immediately valuable, you know?
Absolutely. And today we get two for one. So before we get into the next conversation, here is our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Danielle, and I'm realizing that I have been in a holding pattern instead of doing my best to become my wonderful, productive self. I've even shared with my family and friends that I believed everyone is in a holding pattern, and I am sad that I said that. I remember that you shared with me years ago that our thoughts become our reality. So I believe that the most important thing I can do is to shift my thoughts. Please remind me how to take control of my thoughts. I will share this information with my family and friends, as almost everyone I know is in a holding pattern.
Dearest Danielle, what you're describing is actually a very profound realization. Many people spent years in a holding pattern without noticing it. The fact that you see it and are looking to change it and then want to help others change is powerful, because most people are not aware that they are thinking the same thoughts over and over, and that those thoughts quietly shape their emotions, decisions, and eventually their lives. I'm happy to share effective ways you can help yourself and others become aware of their thoughts without sounding preachy or controlling. The most important step is to have a conversation with your loved ones and share that you have been in a holding pattern and believe that it has been caused by your thoughts. By sharing that this has been an issue you are working on, the people you are speaking to could understand that you're not judging them. If people feel judged, they shut down. You might ask this question to help everyone get on the same page. Have you noticed which of your thoughts keep repeating? This question could help them observe the thought rather than defend it. I believe that questions activate self-awareness far better than advice. You could also share my belief that thought leads to feeling. Feeling leads to action. Action leads to results. I have a simple 3-step process that helped me and that could help you and them. The first step is to notice the thought, then name it. Is it fear, worry, criticism, judgment, or gratitude, or possibility? The third step is to choose a better thought. For example, my old thought was, I am in a holding pattern. And my new thought is, doors and windows of opportunity are opening for me right now. And please remember that positive thoughts create our future. However, we must also remember that they must be our most repetitive thoughts. Awareness is the beginning of freedom, so please be willing to take a look at your most prevalent thoughts. This is a simple and very effective process. Dedicate a day of no complaining, no criticizing, no self-blame. And take note during the day of how often you complain, criticize, and blame yourself. When I did this, I was shocked at how often those thoughts appeared. The good news is that I dedicated myself to become more self-aware, and that when I notice I'm thinking something negative, I change the story to something positive. I first say, cancel, cancel, and then speak positively. And precious Danielle, you don't have to control every thought. What's important is to become aware of them. Awareness alone starts the transformation. I thank you for this important question and am excited to hear from you in the near future as to how your reality becomes better through simply changing your thoughts.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, don't stay in a holding pattern. And write her at askdorothy@lifechangersshow.com.
Brilliant. And speaking of brilliant, for our performance segment, we have the keynote maestro, founder of Life in Tune, a number one charting pianist, producer of Grammy-winning projects, a world-class musician with powerful leadership insight. I should say Maestro Freddie Ravel. Welcome, Maestro Freddie.
Hey, hey, Filippo. Greetings, greetings.
Greetings, and so great to have you on the show. We have to thank our friend and contributing producer, Tess Cacciatore. She might have been the first person that brought you to my attention years and years and years ago, and today we talked about just how many years ago that might have been. But you were doing some amazing things back then, and you just keep amping it up.
Oh, never a dull moment, I have to say.
I think you're just getting, not just getting started, but I'm so excited about what you're doing now, and it feels like you're going to be doing more and more of it. So let's jump into it. Is it okay if I talk about just for a few minutes about a little bit about the past?
Oh, whatever feels good.
Well, we talked about how I was watching Hour of Power, and you were like the part of the power, a big part of the power.
Right. Amen. Right. You're talking about the Hour of Power, right?
The Hour of Power. That's it. That's right.
The Hour of Power. We have that wonderful, some people say it's the longest running television show in history. The beautiful Christian show that I had the great privilege of being invited on a while ago, probably back around 2013. From Bobby Schuller, and went down to Garden Grove, California, to the Crystal Cathedral, where they were filming it, and had the privilege of appearing on it about five different times. Really an amazing experience.
And powerful. I mean, full orchestra and full choir and just very impressive. But then there again, you've worked with Madonna. I mean, I could go on and on, and you worked with NASA and Apple, and I mean, it's like, wow. Each step of the way. Actually, let me ask you this: each step of the way, what were you thinking each step of the way?
I mean, like, if I put on where I was at the day that I was speaking to NASA. I was very interested in speaking to these polymaths, you know, the people that are in the room at NASA. And I talked a lot about their melody because in Life in Tune, which is this methodology that I know we began to talk about earlier today, Filippo, which I use when I speak to people at NASA or when I speak at IBM or when I've spoken to Google, these kinds of events that I do with a piano on stage, right? I have a specific methodology that I've developed over the years called Life in Tune. And it takes melody, harmony, and rhythm, the three building blocks of all music, combines that with dissonance, which is noise, listening skills, which really speaks to the incredible work you just discussed with Doug Knoll, the power of being in, you know, really hearing what is not heard. That's one of the big things about listening. Mm. And then all of that getting you to the score. The score is that desirable outcome that you want as a musician, but it's also that desirable outcome you want in whatever field you go into, whether it's academic, whether it's, you know, you want a great score on your test. You want to conduct a great score. You want to look at the score if you're the conductor of the LA Philharmonic and read the melody, harmony, and rhythm that's in front of you and make sure you get that encore at the end and as you conduct the symphony. Or you simply might want to score an A+ on the next test. Score is one of those words that represent achievement and outcome. It just happens to be musical. It happens to be academic. It happens to be something you hear in the sports world all the time. So that's one of the goals with Life in Tune, is to get to the score. And listening and music and melody particularly is what we talked about at NASA. We're kind of, you're kind of having me start right at NASA. So. But I was in a room full of great leaders and great visionaries that are highly tuned in on who they are and what they stand for. Mm. The people I was speaking to had just recently had launched the Hubble telescope back then. And, you know, these are people who are very clear on their purpose. So in Life in Tune language, I would say they're very clear on their melody, for example. Mm. And the majority of human beings on planet Earth are not clear on their melody. So that's a whole discussion to explore.
That is, and I would love to explore that some more someday. As a matter of fact, wait, aren't you doing a TEDx talk also, or?
Well, I did a TEDx talk.
You did TEDx talk.
A year ago, TEDx Santa Barbara.
That's it.
And it's online, and people could Google it and do it. It was something I did last year with Mark Sylvester, who runs TEDx in Santa Barbara. So yes, I did do a TEDx talk.
That's right.
But what's coming up in the next keynote? I call it a keynote concert because it's like a TED talk and a concert at the same time. And I'll be doing it in San Diego at a conference for about 1,000 people in the energy sector who deal with the dissonance, if you will, of the power grid going down. You know, hurricanes, tornadoes that, you know, hit power structures. And they're the people that are the first responders that get it back up and running. So these are people that deal with dissonance and noise at the highest level. And so what is it that's in music that is dissonant that we can, by just shifting a half step, can transfer the dissonance into resolution?
I love that. And I want to talk more about that. But before we do, it's interesting that you you mentioned first responders, and great respect for first responders. And at the same time, musicians and music in some situations can bring that first responder kind of like, that's exactly what needed to happen in this moment. Mm. And yeah. It's so primal. So take us back as far back as you can. How primal is music?
Well, how far back do you want to go? Let's just talk about for 1 second something really basic, right? When we talk about the origins of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. What do we refer to the first moment of one of the big moments, right?
Bang.
Okay, we don't say the big smell or the big sight or the big touch. Or the big taste. We call it the Big Bang. So right there, out the gate. I mean, like out the gate, humanity immediately says sound, sound, right? Mm. They say that the first thing we hear when we are embryos inside our mother's womb and we start, you know, in pregnancy, as we develop our senses, the first thing that comes are our ears, and the first thing that we hear is our mother's heartbeat. And they say that when we pass away, the last sense to go is hearing. So sound, from the origins of the universe to the origins of our human selves, all the way to death, and some people argue even beyond death. You know, some people believe that there's frequency in the resurrection, if you believe in that, and that there's frequencies that we vibrate into other places beyond that. And some people subscribe to that belief too. But frequency, sound, boom, it has been with us from the origins of the universe. Now, to get a little bit more technical, a little bit more precise, we can say that, you know, language is not that old. You know, Doug.
I heard that. He said
your previous guest
thing.
who is what a beautiful man and beautiful work that he does with empathy and listening, which is another. It's funny that we're on at the same time because I talk a lot about empathy, mindfulness, listening. And
you do.
What is not heard, you know. So,
and you even referenced also the language. It doesn't go that far. He said empathy was before. You say music was before.
Bingo, and it's amazing, right? So in if you think about language, right? I mean, we go back to some of the older cultures like China, India. These are 5,000-year-old cultures. You go back to Africa, it gets tens of thousands of years of language, but not when you think about sound and frequency, grunts and groans and whistles and pounding of drums are all forms of music. In fact, they found a flute in Germany that is carbon dated. It's a vulture's bone. It's carbon dated to about approximately 42,000 years old now. 42,000 years old.
I heard a sound.
Right? Oh, yeah.
There's the piano.
I do have a keyboard here.
We're going to get to hear it in a moment.
I don't see you, but I think you guys might see me. But yes, I'm so used to music that I'm within arm's reach of a piano most of the time.
Nice. And I love how you're on stage doing what you do with a piano. Speaking of want to hear something, definitely, and we're going to get the pleasure of that. You mentioned, actually, Doug's work, when I think of I don't know if the word came up today, but conflict resolution, right? And resolution, you and I were talking about this earlier. You were talking to me about resolution. So share with the audience, if you would, how music resolves and let us experience that, if you would.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, and by the way, I could do this arbitrarily where I'm looking up at the ceiling and let my fingers land. So I know we're being recorded. Some people are seeing me, some are not. But I'm just going to look up at the ceiling and let my fingers land wherever they land. And I look down and I see an A and a B. I landed on an A and a B. I don't know if you can hear this.
Oh, yeah. And it's dissonant.
Right. It could be. Yeah, it doesn't feel like a pleasant sound at all.
A little bit of stress.
A little bit of stress, right? They are slightly in conflict. It's not as there's other ways to play this where it would be even more conflicted, like this. That might sound a little edgier.
Yeah.
These are two notes that are half step apart, but if we put them a whole step apart, this is what I landed on when I was looking up at the ceiling arbitrarily, just letting my fingers land, right? Now, what would resolution sound like? Well, what would happen if we took this note? We have this note. What would happen if we took this note and went down a whole step? Just a whole step. And all of a sudden, this goes from I'm just going down a whole step.
Nice.
Now,
you get Nadia's theme.
Yeah, it could be Nadia's theme. It could be. It could be Nadia's theme. It could be. Right? Da do dee da da.
Yes.
Da, da. Yeah, I'm hearing what you're hearing, which would be E minor. Just like rehearsal, right, Filippo? Just like
better than rehearsal. Oh, listen to you. You don't have to go there, but I'm impressed. Right. Nice.
Yeah, you could go to all kinds of places. But if you getting back to this,
yeah,
beauty's in the ear of the beholder. Some people might go, oh wait, that's great. I mean, that's kind of interesting.
Interesting.
That almost sounds like the news is coming on at 5 o'clock.
Well, like actually, news is appropriate because tension, right?
Totally, you know,
drama.
I mean, think about how we're, you know, the lower one third, you know, the red ribbon coming across the screen. Alert, you know.
If you eat this, you'll die. News at 11.
News at 11, right? If it bleeds, it leads, right? But that would be an example of how quickly music can illustrate tension and resolution. And that's just one example. I mean, it's infinite what you can do with music.
It's brilliant, actually, in how one could leave somebody in suspense. It just dovetails so beautifully with the conversation. If we left in that conflict, like we were speaking about at the beginning of the show, without some kind of a resolution, it's kind of like leaving the music in that space that will stay with us.
Yeah. And remember, a lot of it is reframing. So much of it is contextual. You know, if you play it all by itself, it's not nice. But if you put that inside of a larger framework, other notes, it can sound so emotional that it brings you to tears. You know, even this sound, which is a half step, right? But if you add this, so the half step that was a rub, that was tense, but moving it resolves it. I like to compare these kinds of motions, moving a half step here, moving a half step there, as conflict resolution. Here's conflict. Let's resolve it. Or we could go up too. We don't have to go down, right? We could go up a fifth. And go way up. So how do you take that? Let's say there's a round table and there's five people in a circle and there's arguments between them. And you say, wait a second, you have a rub here, you have a rub here. Shift your perspective. Let's bring empathy to this table first. Right? And like what Doug said, hey, it seems to me that you're a bit angry. The word seem is important. Because it shows that you're not completely judging them. You're just sharing that you're feeling something about them. And that gives them the opportunity to say, you know, I'm not happy. Today really sucked. Ouch. I went to the doctor. Things aren't good. I'm not feeling right. You know, looks like I'm going to go through a divorce. I didn't want to go through this divorce. Right? And this, I'm playing with the intensity of it, right? I'm playing with the intensity of the feeling, right?
And you can add cacophonous rhythms to it too, right?
God.
It's like, yeah.
But if you... thing can get you to the next one. A lot of it is, I'm impressed with the idea of 3,000 prison inmates being transformed. I think that's pretty amazing in Doug's work. But I also have found that music is this elixir that's been going on for tens and tens of thousands of years that has been regulating human emotion. And we, in society today, in the year 2026, we're spending all our time thinking that, oh man, let's put it on Spotify. Let me go to the gym and like listen to beats that make me want to work out more. Let me use certain songs for Christmas and certain songs for birthdays and certain songs, you know, to celebrate the rites of passage, like weddings and bar mitzvahs. And by the way, that's all good. It's beautiful that human beings have rituals and that we use music for it, but we're only scratching the surface. I'm here to tell you, in my journey, I have found that music is a multitasking power tool to give us better lives, to remind us about how to navigate the complexities of life in something that is truly the oldest language on planet Earth, music.
Mm. And we are hardwired for that too.
Yeah.
Right?
There's a poem that I wrote back in 2012. It's called If Music Could Speak. And the opening line is, "Music's the great invitation for mankind to transcend spoken word, to enhance how we think and put into sync so we hear what is mostly not heard." And the goal is to hear what is mostly not heard, right? The goal is for us to develop spidey sense. How do we walk into a space and how do we feel things and sense things on such a high level that we can adjust to the energy, de-escalate if there's a situation that is escalating, and position ourselves for the highest level of success in the next moments to follow? How do we walk into a space and feel that? And to me, music informs us on how to do that.
As in?
For example, melody, harmony, and rhythm are the three building blocks of all music. And everybody who has a purpose and a voice and are clear on what they're saying are singing their melody. You see, the melody is much more than just something in music. It is the I am of who we are. And I think for your show in particular, in your audience, Filippo, this beautiful audience of Life Changes, I believe that this audience has a unique, deep understanding of what it is to be on purpose and be authentic. The authentic voice in music is the melody of music, right? It's not the harmony. It's not the rhythm. If we take a song like... I'm just thinking about the song Summertime right now, which goes like this. That's the melody playing Summertime, right? It's not the chords. That's just the harmony. And it's not the rhythm, which is one, two, three, four. It's just, which is marking the time. It's the melody. The melody is what tells you what the identity of the song is. So our identities are all melodies. when we go out and say, this is what I believe in, this is a product or a service that I am pushing for my business, this is a mission statement that I believe needs to happen, we are stating our own melody, right? Most people are leaving their melody in sort of a state of selfishness or in a state of limited view because they're just thinking about their immediate world.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Yeah. So melody, what you say, your words, of course, dictate the mirror of what gets reflected back to you. That's why your melody is so important. It's important to know what your melody is. And a lot of people can look to their favorite music, for example, the melodies of songs or the words of songs they love, and find resonance with where their melody is. I mean, take a look at your playlist and there's a treasure trove.
Yes.
Of things that subconsciously
absolutely won your soul. Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So that is one, that is like an immediate way to kind of gauge your emotions. And this is, there's a lot of scientific studies on this. People, especially in their developmental years, when they're from, you know, as soon as they enter their teens and they get into, you know, the end of junior high, you get into high school, most of us can recall the music that we were listening to in high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can reference that very easily because they're at this pinnacle of development going from adolescence to adulthood, young adulthood. And that is when so much of the music that you're growing up with at that time and that your body's literally physically growing, mentally growing, you know, the spirit is growing. There's so much transformation going on in those early years. The music that you're listening to has a way of sticking with you the rest of your life.
Freddie, that's the good news and the bad news, though. Isn't it? Because, like, what if we were listening to empowering music at that time?
Well, a lot of people grow up on heavy metal, you know, or they grow up on a lot of music that some people might consider very negative. So what you want to do is as you grow older, you want to always be extending your playlist, just like you want to keep reading more books.
Yeah, good point.
Just like you want to taste different kinds of food, just like you want to get on a plane and travel to different parts of the world.
Mm.
You want to ideally have a life that is rich in experiences so that all your senses are growing, right? Taste buds, smell, sights, what you're listening to. And hopefully music is a big part of it, because as you listen to different forms of music, you start to find a beauty in things that maybe you might not have liked when you were, let's say, 19 years old.
Freddie, in a little bit, we're going to get to hear a really cool song of yours. It's got a great story behind it as well. But before we do, I wonder if you might do something for us and potentially with us, in the sense that I'm feeling like you experience the moment, and you talk about walking into a room and in a sense gathering the feeling, the music, or feeling the melody that's in the room. Would you play a couple minutes of something that you feel is an interpretation of the show so far or this moment?
Sure. Why don't we make this completely? Why don't you let me know three? Why don't you give me three things that happened in this time? I mean, what Doug shared with us, what Mark shared, what Dorothy shared, something about patterns, right? And getting caught in certain patterns. I remembered.
Yeah.
Maybe we can, if you can, give me some of those fresh words and let's create it right on the spot. I have no agenda. I have no,
yes, you didn't know I was going to ask this. And
I didn't even know
you
were going to ask this.
I didn't. I'm sorry, but I'm feeling it like that. You're you're brilliant in so many ways, and of course the playing is beautiful. And then I heard you play your piece earlier, and I can't wait to share it with the audience. I would say that empathy, obviously, and you brought even that word up when you and I were talking earlier today. So definitely empathy, and then putting our focus into what we want to have happen, and then the music being such a big, deep part of our lives, and maybe not getting the attention it needs or the recognition or maybe not holding that place. So I want to like elevate music in this moment and in our life and celebrate it, thanks to what you're sharing with us.
Okay. So empathy, focus, and revealing, because you talked about something that's kind of hidden, and make it go to the light. Right. Empathy, by the way, when I think of empathy, if I have to come up with a quick, it's a very beautiful concept, the idea of mindfulness, compassion, these things, but also the idea that when you can walk in another person's shoes, I think that is what gets you to empathy. The ability to put yourself in that person's perspective, right? So you said empathy, and then something hidden that grows into something beautiful, right? So my thought process is empathy. First of all, I'm struck by, and this is all coming to me right now in the moment, empathy. E-A-I-E, E-A-I-E. Just taking the vocals, the vowels. E-I-E, E-I-E. Empathy. So it's hidden, so I'm going to go down. Start up and go down. And when I end it, I think I'm going to go up. Empathy, go down, but end it going up. Because I'm going to start hidden. So that's, I'm trying to share the process of my craziness.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Empathy, and then empathy is a feeling of, hey, brother, I get where you're coming from.
Keynote maestro Freddie Ravel. Thank you. That felt great. That felt great. You know how sometimes, you know better than most, how sometimes we can't express ourselves in words, and there you go. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
For bringing that forward.
What's very interesting about melody, harmony, and rhythm, it's like a circle. And you can step in the circle, and you can start with any. It's sort of like creating a stew. You can start cutting the mushrooms, or you could start sauteing things. And you, in other words, you can come at it from the rhythm, you can come at it from the melody, or you can come at it from the harmony. or you can come at it from the words. In this case, it came from the word.
Also,
empathy,
yeah.
Right? And the E-I-E.
So you listen in so many different ways, and that all comes to play. Did you learn any of this, maybe not directly, but maybe indirectly or both, from your parents?
Well, my mother for sure. My mother, who God rest her soul. I lost my mom last year. And Filippo, you and I spoke, a little earlier today, yes. And I learned that you too, both of us lost our moms last year in 2025. And my condolences, because man, losing your mom's a big one, man. And but my mom was 87.
Well, I just learned that the first sound we hear is our mother's heart.
Well, hey, right? Come on, right?
I learned that from you.
Yeah, mom's got a pretty big role in our destiny, right?
Talk about the beginning of sound.
Holy cow, right? And I think in both our cases, because I know you're also a musician, Filippo. But I know for me, my mother came from Colombia, South America, mm-hmm. and the cumbia mm-hmm. is the national dance of Colombia, and it is filled with joy and filled with beautiful rhythm and gorgeous dancing. And my mom was a walking catalog of all the music of Latin America, not just Colombia. She would sing music from all over Latin America. But so I grew up with this intense Latin feel in the music. And then my father was completely from another part of the world. My father's roots, his parents were from Ukraine.
Wow.
So, you know, think of the great Eastern European composers, you know, the Tchaikovskys and the Stravinskys. And he also had some Polish roots. So think of Chopin, you know. And so he grew up with that energy, and of course the classical music. And so lots of times people come and when they hear my group or my music or my albums, you'll hear this crazy combination of European harmonies and classical, you know, bumping up against a samba or a salsa tune,
and it works.
And it's this crazy combination of stuff that lands in my crazy brain. But we've been very lucky with the success of that band and the records we've put out four albums, and that's a whole other dimension of my life.
Well, we're going to talk about one particular song, and then we're going to get to hear a different version of it, a live version of it. But before we do, I do want to talk about your book. I want to plug it before you finish it, because I'm hoping you finish it sooner than later. Tell us about it, and what do we have to look forward to?
Thank you, Filippo. I'm very excited about it because I'm planning to make it about a 30 to 40 minute read. I'm inspired very much by Lao Tzu's Art of War, because it's profound, but it's small. And you can carry it on a plane and go on a 1-hour flight and get off the plane and read and have read the whole book. Mm. I want something digestible and immediately usable. And that's what this will be. It will be around the concepts of life in tune. I want to save the title as a surprise because the title's very special. But I can tell you the subtitle. And the subtitle is How to Live Life in Tune in an out-of-tune world. That's the subtitle. But I want to give people very specific tools on how to find their melody and what it is to find harmony, because harmony, you need two or more notes to make harmony. You cannot make harmony with one note. You can make a melody with one note, but you can't do it with harmony. Mm. Harmony means you gotta elevate people around you. You have to be in a collaborative spirit to create harmony. So harmony goes into tribes, community, people, team building in the corporate world, which is what I do a lot mm-hmm. with harmony. And then rhythm is something that is, you know, when people talk about rhythm, they talk about groove and tempo and the feeling of things with the speed of something. But at the end of the day, rhythm comes down to one word, and the word is time. It's always related to time. Which is kind of a profound idea, because time is non-negotiable, right? No matter what we do, the seconds go by and we can never go back to them. What I said 5 seconds ago is gone. I can't do anything about it, right? And it also speaks to the value of time, which means that right now, in this moment, that I'm here with you, Filippo, and with Mark and with Dorothy and your listeners, right now in this moment, there is nothing, nothing more important than being present now. Nothing is more important than the moment. Mm.
Thank you for sharing that and sharing this moment with us. And since we're at this place, lifeintune.com, just like it sounds, lifeintune.com, and is where you can learn more about Freddie and Life in Tune, and also his music's available all over. We need to get links up to on the webpage, Freddie, but Spotify and Apple to Apple and Amazon, right?
All those places. It's pretty easy to find it. Actually, you just type in Freddie Revelle in Google, and what you know, it all pops up there.
Actually, I think they could just type in Keynote Maestro, and you
pop heard
up.
About that, right?
And there he is.
It's true.
So, we're going to get to end this great doubleheader show with quite a special song and quite a special story. Actually, what do you want to share with us about what we're going to hear? And the how it got to where it got to.
Okay. The song that you and I talked about was Sunny Side Up, which is a song that went to number one in the United States on NAC Radio, which is here in Los Angeles, it would be The Wave, 94.7 The Wave. But we had a number one song with this, and it was a great honor to have that. When we were doing soundcheck just before we came on, Filippo, the signal wasn't hot enough.
And, oh, right.
And your technician said, Freddie, do you have something else with a little hotter signal? And I said, listen, let's go with the flow. Whatever's going to work. He said, well. And so I played a second song for him, and the signal was better for him. So I think we're going to do that.
Okay.
It's on the same album, and it's called Echo de Amor, the Echo of Love.
And that's what it needed to be then.
That's what it's meant to be. That's what it's meant to be.
I do want to say, though, that the story about how the other song came out, and then we'll learn more about this one, but how you brought out the song and it charted at what?
God, when it first showed up, it was at like 56. I was even amazed that we got to 56. you know, I mean, you're in the ring with like at that time when I was, in the middle of the release of this album, the top artists were Sade, Sting, Stevie Wonder, Whitney Houston, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
People like that. So you're, you know, it's, I felt
Freddie Revelle, evidently,
you know. But we got this song that just really, really worked and really landed in a great way. And I couldn't believe it. It actually got to number one.
Well, so, people are going to have to go look for that and get that and enjoy it. In the meantime, tell us about this song and then looking forward to hearing it live.
Yes. That number one song is Sunny Side Up. It's on the same album that this one is on. And this is the opening song on that record. Back in the old days, everybody, when there were record labels like Universal Music and Atlantic and Warner Brothers, these were the big labels. And so this was released on Universal Records, and it's called Echo de Amor. And I'm doing something that I have never done on a Zoom call. I'm going to play the background track and play live piano to it.
So cool. Thank you for doing that here.
If everyone's okay with the journey, I'm going to start.
Journey.
Here we go. So
here's
dear God,
Freddie Revelle with Echo d'Amor live on the Life Changes Show.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. Without an engineer trying to start and stop it, but there it is.
I was watching you do all that. Thank you so much for playing. When was the last time you actually played that? Because that's another thing too, probably.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do have, I've got a great band. I've had a band now for 30 years and we do concerts primarily in Southern California. But we've played all over the world. But we do quite a few shows here because we're based here in Los Angeles.
Nice.
So
I got to catch you live. So you've done these.
We do these. Yeah. One of the places we play at quite frequently is Vibrato.
Yes.
Herb Albert's beautiful place. I think you were there, Filippo, once,
I think,
right?
So I do right? Think so.
And, but we'll be there on the 3rd of May, 2026, for those of you who might be in Los Angeles on a Sunday.
And, 3rd of May, and we also have that you're going to be at Global Leaders, and so we have links to that.
That's
the Life Changes Show page.
Australia, yeah, I'm going to be speaking in Australia, in Sydney, in July 22nd, for the World Council of Credit Unions. How's that?
They need it. We all need
they
it.
They need it, man. The next concert I actually have is in 2 weeks. I'll be playing in St. Martin in the Caribbean with Jeffrey Skunk Baxter.
Wow, fun. Yeah, gosh. I know it's work, but fun.
Oh, man. That's the thing. Music is the most fluid thing. It can be applied to so many situations. But I think the world of human potential is the next frontier.
Well, thank you for helping bridge that potential with music and bringing us back to harmony and melody and all that you talked about in rhythm. Life in Tune, just like it sounds, lifeintune.com. Find Freddie Ravel. Freddie is FreddieRavel. And then, of course, you can always look up the Keynote Maestro. And you will find Freddie Ravel. Catch him where you can. Freddie, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. I can't wait for the next time we connect, whether it's watching you live or another great conversation like this in the future. You're awesome. And all the best to you.
Thank you, brother. I look forward to seeing you again soon. God bless. Yes,
until then. Wow, what a show. Oh my gosh. And I'm sorry to say that that's it for tonight, because I really feel like we could have just gone on, especially with the music, man. Well, with another big thank you to Freddie Ravel and another big thank you to Doug Knoll. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejeur, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, and along with our whole family here at the Life Changes Show, we remind you that as your life changes, like it surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at The Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.